Thank you very much. It's an immense privilege to be here. Thank you to the invitation from ISCAS and the permission of the master of the college and the hospitality of the college this evening. I'm really glad to be here, and thank you for coming to listen to someone talk about the relationship between science and faith. I work at Durham University, which is 200 miles north of London, and I was on a train the other day from Durham to London, and I sat down and the person beside me said, what do you do? Well, I said, I'm a Methodist minister and I teach theology these days. I'm never quite sure about saying that to people because you never quite know what people's reaction will be. And this man's eyes seemed to fill with fear as he thought to himself, oh no, all the way to London, sitting beside this religious fanatic. So he quickly tried to change the topic of conversation. He said, what did you do before that? I said, I did research in theoretical astrophysics. This time his eyes glazed. And he thought, what on earth does he mean by that? But he knew it was something to do with science. And so asked me the question that lots of people have asked me over the years, how can you be a scientist and a Christian? Or to put the paraphrase on it, how can you be a scientist and a Christian with integrity? How can you hold those two things together in a way that enriches each other? And that's a difficult question for us in a culture in which we live, which often says that the two are in conflict with one another. And that those who are scientists and are Christians live a kind of double existence, believing one thing on a Sunday in church and something else the rest of the week, Monday to Saturday. That's the type of story that you hear, or you hear from Richard Dawkins or Lawrence Krauss or other folk, to say that if you're a scientist, then there's no way you can be a religious believer. The two are completely different. One rules out the other. And I could have shown you a clip of Richard Dawkins or Lawrence Krauss, but I thought I'd go even a little further into popular culture. This is an Irish stand-up comedian called Dara O'Brien in his stand-up routine talking about his own view of religion. O'Brien's an interesting character because he has a degree in astrophysics. This is just a little bit of what he has to say.
We and all the kind of Catholicism and all that kind of stuff. And even that gets on my nerves at this stage, because I'm not a man for text and holding to text really strictly, like laws and rules and regulations. And the Bible thing in particular, for God's sake, we've moved on, right? If you're a religious person, fine, go for that, whatever you're into. But at least in this part of the world, we don't take literally. There's nobody like you as an American who goes, no, Genesis is a historical fact. And you go, for God's sake, Genesis, which is a load of fairy stories to get the kids to go to bed on a donkey ride to Jerusalem 2,000 years ago, right? Stop taking it literally. It's only the Bible. It's not gospel. Not every word in it is supposed to be true, right? For God's sake, I think if you give up about evolution, right? This wonderful thing that we've invented and we came up with this fantastic theory to explain incredibly complex things, and people go, no, no, it's not in the book. It can't be right. Other little arguments, creatious arguments, like, you know, how could the eye just have evolved? It must be a gift from God. And you go, no, you're not getting the point. The whole point of evolution is that random things just happened and the useful ones hung around, right? Basically, there were loads of blind monkeys. And then one day, a one-eyed monkey wandered into the middle of it all and rode everything left, right, and centre. And he was king of the monkeys until Mr. Peckin, two eyes, sat there in the clearing. It's a wonder I'm not invited to more churches in Alabama. We just the best people go, no, God made, poof, poof, there you go, God made us exactly as we are, right? No, of course he didn't, for God's sake. Three arguments against that. A, have a look at yourself. If you truly think you were created by God, get out of the shower in the morning and look at yourself for a while in the mirror. This is the same guy, apparently, who made mountaintops and sunsets. What kind of off day exactly was he having? When he threw you together. Argument two, if we were truly created by God, then why do we still occasionally bite the insides of our own mouths? Have you ever felt less divine you know, when you suddenly go, oh, I shouldn't think you don't believe in America. I seem to have chewed at my cheek there. I seem to have forgotten where my lips were. I'm so eager to eat that plate of pasta, I've eaten through my own face. An argument seen against a divine creator, the appendix. Why would he put it in you when it does nothing except randomly kill you?
Well, that's typical, isn't it, of the kind of conversation that goes on about whether you can be a scientist and what the nature of scripture are we designed and all the rest of it. I'm an astrophysicist by training. I'm sure you know what that is. Theoretical astrophysics is very simple. Twinkle, twinkle, little star, how I wonder what you are. That's what astrophysics is. The only trouble is astrophysicists go on and say, up above the world is a high contracting ball of hydrogen gas undergoing nuclear fusion. It doesn't quite rhyme in the same way. But that's my background. And what's interesting within astrophysics is that the dialogue between science and faith is much more complicated, much more exciting, much more textured than just a simplistic conflict between the two. And that's what I want to try and illustrate this evening. In 1987, Stephen Hawking published A Brief History of Time. He wanted to sell about 40,000 copies. He eventually sold about 10 million copies worldwide. And you ask yourself the question, why was this book so popular? After all, it dealt with everyday concepts like Riemannian geometry and 26-dimensional space. I mean, why was it? Well, part of the reason, I think, was Professor Hawking's own personal story. A remarkable human story of triumph over illness and disability. And Hawking himself has become a cult personality. I know that because he's the only scientist who's appeared both on The Simpsons and on Star Trek The Next Generation. That makes you a cult personality. But I think there's more to this book than just that. Carl Sagan, the American astrophysicist and agnostic atheist, perhaps said, this is a book about God, or perhaps about the absence of God. We'll come back to the absence of God a little later. But Hawking, like many cosmologists, finds himself starting to deal, propelled by the science, with questions of God. Another is Paul Davis, who's had a long and distinguished career in cosmology and the popularization of cosmology. And Davis, in his 1983 book, God and the New Physics, partly tongue-in-cheek but partly seriously, wrote, in my opinion, science offers a surer path to God than religion. For him, his devotion to science has led him back to some of the big questions which science itself may not be able to answer. Now, is it a surer path to God, or is it about the absence of God? Actually, I think it's probably something in between and far more interesting and exciting. And in order to illustrate this, I've got three things I need to do this evening. The first is to introduce you to the universe. Now, that's going to be very quick because it's a pretty big place. Secondly, we'll talk about the origin of current understanding of the universe, the Big Bang. And then thirdly, I'll go on to talk about the big questions, the philosophical, theological questions that have come out of the science, not just imposed by people with religious faith, but people like Paul Davis, who have no religious axe to grind, who've said, hey, there's something interesting here. So that's what I intend to do. Hope that's all right with everyone. If it's not, I'm in a bit of a fix, because that's what I've prepared. But let's see where we go. So first of all, let me introduce you to this object here. This is UDFJ 395-46284. Astronomers have great imagination in naming their galaxies at times. And this is a small, actually not very special galaxy in lots of ways. It's about 1,000 times smaller than the Milky Way galaxy, our own galaxy. But what's really interesting about it is that this is one of the furthest objects we've ever seen in the universe. This is Hubble, and it's looking at a patch of sky in what we now call the Hubble Ultra Deep Field, and it looks long and hard and finds this galaxy, and this galaxy is so far away that the light from this galaxy has taken 13.2 billion years to reach us. Now, the light from the sun takes about 8 minutes to reach the surface of the Earth. The light from this galaxy takes 13.2 billion years. And of course, as you look out into the universe, so you look back in time. And we can draw it a little like this. Here's Hubble looking out into the universe, and as you look out into the universe, so you look back in time. This is the Hubble Ultra Deep Field, the patch of sky that we were looking at, and actually that galaxy is within a billion years of the beginning of the universe, the Big Bang. Some people say, will we ever be able to look right back to the Big Bang itself? Well, not quite. I'm afraid round about this area, the universe becomes very cloudy indeed. You can't see past it. But even so, we see an amazing universe. Let's have a look at it in a slightly different way. Some of you will have seen this piece of video before. It's called Powers of Ten. It was made a few years ago. And what we're going to do is we're going to go on a journey by expanding the size of the picture by a factor of 10 every 10 seconds. So every 10 seconds, you're going to be 10 times further away from the picnic in the park. As we begin to expand the size of the picture, so we'll see the universe at different scales. We'll see different structures to it. Left-hand side of the screen is giving us a distance scale, so that the squares, as you see them, that one is 1,000 meters squared, and you begin to lose any detail of the city. You see this big expanse of water. Is it an ocean? What is it? At this point, we need an Apollo rocket or a space shuttle to get this high. And as we begin to leave the atmosphere and look back, we begin to see a great lake beginning to emerge. And this is the continent of North America beginning to come. And now we look back on this beautiful blue planet, our home, the Earth. If you watch Star Trek, we're traveling at warp factor one or so at the moment. In a moment, you'll see a horizontal line extend across the screen. That'll be the true speed of light at this perspective. There it is. That ellipse is the orbit of the moon, about 240,000 miles from the Earth. That's the average distance that a human being walks in their lifetime. No idea how scientists calculate that, by the way, but that's an interesting and trivial fact. This is now the orbit of the Earth, and we remind ourselves that our planet is one planet in a solar system. Planets here's our close neighbours, the rocky inner planets, Mercury, Venus, Mars. Here's our hot ball of hydrogen gas undergoing nuclear fusion, the Sun. Now we begin to see the orbit, so, or we were, which, oh dear. You know that school definition of science? That if it moves, it's biology. If it smells, it's chemistry. And if it doesn't work, it's physics. I'm basically a physicist. And my piece of video has just broken down. I've started again. So in one sense, I'm going to have to fill in a little bit while you see the animation again. Or I could just be quiet and allow you to see it. Maybe I'll just be quiet and allow you to see it just for a little bit. And then I'll come back to it. Okay, that's a bit better. Thank you. Right, we're back. At least I hope we're back. Remember, horizontal line across the screen, that's the true speed of light. Ellipse is the orbit of the moon, 240,000 miles from the Earth. Now we're going to see the inner planets, the rocky planets, the Earth, Mercury, Venus, Mars, our own Sun, the star, about a million times the size of the Earth. And then as we move into the outer planets, these are the big gas giants, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune. In fact, this piece of video is so old that there's another orbit right at the edge of the solar system, and that's Pluto. In the days when some of us thought that Pluto was a planet, now most of us don't think that Pluto's a planet, just a bit of rock that got lost. We're now moving through a vast cloud of comets called the Oort cloud. Millions and millions of comets, so small you can't see them. It was a disturbance in these comets that led, we think, to the dinosaur extinction about 65 million years or so ago. I'm going to draw the constellations onto the sky at this point in our journey. They would look exactly as they do from the surface of the Earth. That's because the background stars are so far away. Well, we've run out of space, if you'll forgive the pun, on the left-hand side of the screen. We're now going to talk about distances in light years. And at about 10 light years, we begin to see our Sun as one star in a collection of stars which make up the Milky Way galaxy. A collection of 100 billion stars. You might see some clouds of purples and greys. They are maternity hospitals for stars. They'll give birth to about 10,000 stars or so on average. And as we look back at our Milky Way galaxy, and you see a spiral pattern of gas and dust and stars. 100 billion stars, and from one side of the galaxy to the other is a distance of about 100,000 light years. We now begin to see the universe on the scale of galaxies. So each of these dots of light is going to be a galaxy, typically containing about 100 billion stars. Galaxies cluster together. The way they cluster together is very important for helping us to understand the very early universe. Our nearest cluster is the Virgo cluster. There it was. And how many galaxies are there in the universe? Well, it's of the order of 100 billion. Now, I know it's late at night, but how many stars are there in the universe? It's very easy. You just have to multiply 100 billion by 100 billion. And the answer is a lot. I mean, that's of the order of the grains of sand on the beaches of the world, if you can imagine that. Now, if you come from a Christian background and you have a sense of some of the scriptural words that particularly are in the Psalms, as we retrace our journey, just think about the vastness of the universe. And Psalm 19, verse 1, the heavens declare the glory of God. Or the psalmist who in Psalm 8 said, when I look at the heavens, the moon and the stars, the work of your fingers, what are human beings that you're mindful of them? Well, we've come back to the Earth and we're back in Chicago. And the couple who are having a picnic are now having an afternoon snooze. You can tell by the way they're dressed what decade this was made in. You can tell by the way I'm dressed what decade I'm still stuck in. But the most important thing about modern science is the way that the very large is now connected with the very small. So let's continue our journey, this time making the picture smaller by a factor of 10 every 10 seconds. Let's go into the man's hand and see what we can see. Well, at about 1 centimeter squared, 1 millimeter squared, you can just about resolve some of the kind of layers of skin on the back of your own hand. But let's make the picture smaller and see what we can see. First of all, we begin to see blood vessels. They begin to emerge, and we're going to make the picture smaller and go inside a blood vessel. That's a white blood cell. Inside the white blood cell is now the cell nucleus. And inside the cell nucleus, beginning to emerge, are the spiral coils of DNA, stuff that makes us in part. Now, DNA is a very complex molecule, but we're going to focus on one carbon atom in that molecule. So the carbon atom is going to appear in the center of the screen. And we're going to go inside the carbon atom. Here it is. And we're going to enter the carbon atom just about now. And the first thing that we encounter are electrons. In this animation, they're shown to be fuzzy. That's because of quantum theory. We haven't got time to do quantum theory this evening. Praise the Lord, a number of people say. But we move through the electrons, and you remember that in the atom, the nucleus is very small indeed. If it was the size of a soccer ball, then the atom would be the size of a soccer stadium. And here's the nucleus, in carbon's case, made up of protons and neutrons. And the protons and neutrons are made up of things called quarks. We can't show you what quarks are like because there's a particular force that keeps them stuck in to the protons and neutrons. You can't rip them out. And, well, that's about the end of our story so far. Now, a number of you will have seen that piece of video before. I mean, I've seen it many, many times. It still fills me with awe as I look at the beauty of the universe on the very largest and smallest of scales. If that's awe-inspiring, then where it all came from is even more inspiring. The model that describes the origin of the universe was nicknamed the Big Bang by Fred Hoyle. Hoyle didn't like the theory at all. He said it has all the elegance of a girl jumping out of a birthday cake at a party. And he nicknamed it the Big Bang, a name has stuck. And it says that 13.7 billion years ago, everything that I've shown you, the 100 billion stars and 100 billion galaxies, all of it, was small enough to fit through the eye of a needle. At that point, the universe began to expand rapidly in what's called the Big Bang. The next slide, I tried to put the history of the universe on one slide. Forgive me for being so bold. Our present age is 13.7 billion years. Some of us feel it more than others at times, particularly if you get off a plane from the UK here in Australia. I think. And what we can do, we think, is with fairly good confidence, describe the universe back in time. So we think our current laws of physics, that's what the universe was like when it was only 1 million years old. That's a big jump from 13.7 billion. This is not to scale, by the way. In fact, our laws of physics work pretty well to describe the universe when it was only 1 second old. And if that isn't sufficient, many folk believe that our laws of physics work pretty well right back to 10 to the minus 43 of a second. If you're not a mathematician, that's 1 divided by 10 followed by 42 zeroths of a second. That's a very, very small fraction. If you're a biologist or an engineer or a normal person, if you know what I mean by that, you say, basically, that's zero, isn't it? Well, not quite. At that point, our laws of physics break down. And it's really frustrating. You've seen a lot of the story, and then when you get to the really interesting part, you don't know what happens. It's like if two countries were playing a certain test match, and it got to the stage where one country needed 20 runs to win. And I happened to be driving in the Lake District in the north of England, and the radio kept losing its signal. And you think, what is it? Listen to this test match for 5 days. And then when it gets to the really interesting bit, I'm not going to know what's happened. Well, that's the kind of frustration, and I'll come back to that in a moment. The universe at 10 to the minus 43 of a second is very small, a fraction of a centimeter across. It begins to expand rapidly. As it expands, it cools. At 10 to the minus 35 of a second, quarks appear in the universe. The quarks get together to form hydrogen and helium between, protons and neutrons, which form hydrogen and helium between 1 and 1,000 seconds. The visible matter in the universe is at that point about 75% hydrogen, 25% helium, a little bit of lithium and deuterium, but nothing much to write home about. And then to cut a long story short, over these billions of years, stars and galaxies emerge out of vast clouds of molecular hydrogen. Now you may say, just hold on a moment, how do you know that's true? As the Lord said to Job in the Old Testament, where were you when I laid the foundations of the world? And you could say exactly the same to cosmologists. Now of course, cosmology is slightly different science to the way that we view science these days. I mean, you can't ask an undergraduate here at this university to go into a lab and explode a universe in a Big Bang. I mean, it's a unique thing. And what Big Bang cosmology is about is rather like what happens when a detective like Miss Marple appears on the scene of a crime. she's not seen the crime happen. What she does is try to reconstruct what actually happened on the basis of the evidence that she sees. And the same has been true of Big Bang cosmology. I haven't got time to go through the evidence in detail this evening, but three pieces of evidence have been important. The first was discovered in the period 1910 to 1930 by V.M. Slipher and Edwin Hubble and others, who saw that the starlight from distant galaxies, the light from distant galaxies, was redder than it should be. And in 1929, Hubble said, that's the Doppler shift. It's because the galaxies are all moving away from us, or strictly, the space between the galaxies was getting bigger. And if it was getting bigger, where did it all start off from? The second had to wait till 1965, when we discovered the microwave background radiation, a form of radiation that pervades the whole of space, produced in the first few moments of the Big Bang. And then in the late 1980s, we were able to measure the abundance of helium in the universe and find that it was in good agreement with theoretical predictions from the Big Bang. And more recently, we've been able to confirm some of this with results from the Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe, which looked at the microwave background across the sky and looked at its temperature variations, its polarization of the light. And it told us that it's not a bad theory, but hear me right on this. This doesn't mean that the Big Bang is proved. When we get to big science like this, we don't talk about proof. We talk about our best model for explaining the evidence. And there are certain things with this model which we still don't know. Some of it is quite embarrassing. One of the most embarrassing things is that we don't know what most of the universe is made of. About 23% of the universe is in the form of dark matter, a form of matter that we know is there and exerts a gravitational force, but we don't know what it's made of. Another 73% of the universe, we call it dark energy, and we're not entirely sure what that is. Well, we're really not sure what that is. Which means, if you do the calculations, that we only know about 4% of what the universe is made of. You might say, how on earth can you stand in front of a group of people and talk about the origin of the universe if you only know what 4% of the universe is made of? Well, fair point. Although we know that we only know what 4% of the universe is. But then, perhaps a bigger question for the Big Bang model. And that is, you remember I talked about our laws of physics breaking down at 10 to the minus 43 a second. What happens at the very first moment of the universe's history? And this is because of limits of the two great theories of 20th century physics. General relativity and quantum theory. And it leaves us with a question mark at this point. Now, in order to describe this to you, I've got about 30 seconds to describe both general relativity and quantum theory. So if you haven't switched off already or gone to sleep, maybe for the next 30 seconds, now is the time. Let me put it like this. The general theory of relativity, and here's Albert Einstein, its discoverer, deals with the universe on the largest of scales. It describes stars, planets, galaxies, the universe itself, and every way you apply it, it works beautifully. Quantum theory, and here's one of its proponents, Niels Bohr, describes the universe on the very smallest of scales. It describes protons, electrons, and every way you apply it, it works beautifully. And most of the time, these two theories work independently, rather like physicists being down different ends of the corridor in the physics department. They never meet, apart from at one point in the universe's history, 10 to the minus 43 a second. At that point, the universe, remember, is very, very small. Quantum theory says, this is my area. General relativity says, just hold on a moment. This is about describing the whole universe. This is my area. And the trouble is, the two don't fit together. That's why we want a theory which brings these two together, a quantum theory of gravity, which many people are working on, whether it's through string theory or M theory or a whole number of other theories. But that's the frustration. And because our present laws of physics break down, as I talked about, physicists get rather frustrated by this. A number of years ago, in this book, God and the Astronomers, Robert Jastrow wrote about this frustration in this way. I'm sorry about the sexist language. This was written a few years ago. Jastrow said, "For the scientist who has lived by his faith in the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He scaled the mountains of ignorance. He's about to conquer the highest peak. And as he pulls himself over the final rock, he's greeted by a band of theologians who've been sitting there for centuries." Now then, are you all still with me so far? I mean, I've talked about the universe on the largest of scales, and I've talked about the Big Bang model. I want to go on and say, okay, what does this mean for the big questions of faith, theology, and philosophy? Is that all right? Before I do, let me just note that within the Christian community, there continues to be some disagreement over some of these matters. And it's important for me just to acknowledge this. There are some Christians who say, everything that I've talked about so far about the universe being billions of years old is actually wrong. These Christians will say that the first chapter of Genesis is meant to be read as a scientific textbook, giving us the dating of 6,000 years. Other Christians, equally committed to the authority of Scripture, say no, the first chapter of Genesis isn't meant to be read as a scientific textbook. It's a theological textbook. Its primary interest is in who God is, rather than the timescales over what he's done. Now, Christians still disagree about this, and there may be some questions and answers or disagreements when we come to the question time. That's fair enough. I just need to acknowledge that. For what it's worth, my own position is that the first chapter of Genesis isn't meant to be read as a scientific text. In fact, I think it's more like a song or a hymn of praise, that the writer of Genesis wants to gather us up into excitement of who this creator God is, and to sing in worship. I quite like the often quoted thing from Galileo: the scriptures are meant to tell us how to go to heaven, not how the heavens go. But I think one of the consequences of some of the disagreement within the Christian church on the dating of the universe has meant that we have lost the big questions that those outside of the church are asking. In our shouting at each other, we haven't listened to some of the big questions that are out there. And let me just, in the last part of the talk, just pick out four big questions. The first is this, the question of origins. Or to put it bluntly, does the Big Bang prove God? The kind of argument that goes, if the universe began with a big explosion, who lit the blue touch paper? Who set the whole thing off? It must be God, people argue. And in fact, instead of that a question mark, we insert God as the explanation here. It was used by Pius XII and an Oxford mathematician called E.A. Milne in a brilliant book on general relativity and the expansion of the universe. He ended by saying, "The first cause of the universe is left for the reader to insert, but our story is incomplete without him." Now, is that a good argument for the existence of God? I have to say, I don't think it is. We've always known for quite some time that there are problems of logic with using this cosmological argument in its temporal form. Can you use cause and effect and apply it to the whole universe? And what about the nature of time? What does it mean to ask what came before the universe? But more importantly for me, there are two consequences of this argument, or two theological dimensions which I worry about. The first is what Charles Coulson once called the God of the gaps. And Coulson said, beware if science has a gap in it of using God as the explanation for the gap. Because increasingly, as science explains more and more of its own area, God is forced out and becomes irrelevant. The second problem is the problem of deism. The deist belief was a God who started off the universe and then went off for a cup of tea not to have anything more to do with the universe. A God who only interacts with the universe at 10 to the minus 43 a second. Trouble is that if you read the New Testament seriously, the images are not of a God who reaches out his hand and lights a blue touch paper, but they're a God who holds the universe in the palm of his hand, keeping it in existence. Hebrews 1, upholding the universe by his word of power, it says. The images are not of a God who, if you like, smashes a champagne bottle against the hull of the universe and pushes it out to sea, saying, cheerio folks, see you on Judgment Day. The images are more of a God who holds the universe together, keeping it afloat moment by moment. So that Paul writes to a group of Christians in Colossae and says, in him all things hold together, in him all things cohere. You see, the Christian understanding of a creator God is not someone who simply interacts with the universe right at the start. It's of a God who creates and sustains every moment of the universe's history. Whether it's 6,000 or 13.7 billion years, it doesn't matter. The creator God sustains the universe moment by moment. And actually, if you have a view which is based on a God of the gas model or a deistic creator, then Stephen Hawking comes along and says, I might be able to give an explanation of that very first moment of the universe's history. And your God of the gaps or deistic creator is under threat from that. If, however, I suggest to you you have a much more biblical view of God as creator, then all Hawking is doing is in filling in a little more of the gap, showing us a little more of the wonders of science. Kepler once said that science is thinking God's thoughts after him. And I'm quite excited. Whether M-theory is successful or not, we'll see. But I'm excited about the possibility that one day we might be able to fill in that little gap. And that doesn't worry me as a Christian or my faith. Because God is the one who sustains it. You might say, well, that sounds a bit airy-fairy. But what does that actually mean? Well, I think it means that does the Big Bang prove God? No, it doesn't. But I'm left with the question, what is the origin of the laws of physics? Because Hawking and others might come along and say, well, the universe began through a quantum fluctuation. I think we could ask, where does quantum theory itself come from? That's not a God of the gaps argument, because science assumes the physical laws. It doesn't appear to explain them. And so we're left with a question, what is the origin of the laws of physics? My friend, who's one of the world's leading cosmologists at the moment, is not a Christian. He wouldn't go anywhere near the Christian church. But he's fascinated, intrigued with this question of where do the laws of physics come from? Second, the question of purpose. And this is the flip side, to put it bluntly. Does the Big Bang disprove God? You've probably heard this argument. Science tells us that the universe came through a Big Bang. The Bible tells me that the universe was the sovereign creation of God. And then people pause and say, now, which are you going to choose? And I have to say, with respect, Professor Dawkins does this. He says, once I've got a scientific description, that's all I need. And I just think this is far too simplistic. Let me use an old and silly illustration. What is a kiss? Well, a kiss is the approach of two pairs of lips, the reciprocal transmission of carbon dioxide and microbes, and the juxtaposition of two orbicular muscles in a state of contraction. That is a kiss in scientific terms. But if I go to my wife Alison when I get back to the UK and go to her and say, my dear, let me get together with you for a mutual transmission of carbon dioxide and microbes. Let me juxtapose my orbicular muscle in state of contraction with yours. She would say, get lost. You see, in that context with my wife, the carbon dioxide is a true description of the kiss. But it's not sufficient. In that context with my wife, I want to talk about meaning, value and purpose, which is the true definition of a kiss. Actually, both are true, but different. Carbon dioxide, meaning, value and purpose. And to fully understand what a kiss is about, I need both. So when it comes to the universe, I'm excited to say that I believe that God is the sole creator of the universe. But I'm also excited to learn through science how he did it, and to hold those as complementary truths. So, does the Big Bang disprove God? No, it doesn't. But we're left with the question, why is there something rather than nothing? And those of you who know a bit of philosophy will know that's an age-old philosophical question. Third question is the question of design. And this is, if you can't prove God through the Big Bang, or disprove God through the Big Bang, is there anything about modern cosmology that might show a God who's a designer? The answer to this is, well, possibly for some, perhaps. Because for some, there are things within the universe which seem to point them, at the very least, towards God. Not prove God in the old way that the design argument worked, but maybe just point to a deeper story. So, for example, anthropic balances. These are the things which we've discovered in the law and circumstance of the universe have to be just right to make possible life. Paul Davis calls it the Goldilocks enigma. Let me show you just an illustration of this. Imagine you have a universe-making machine. On that machine, you'd have two dials. One is the expansion rate of the universe, the Big Bang force. The other is the gravitational force, the thing that pulls everything together. Imagine you're listening to a very boring lecture on cosmology, and you want something to do. And so you build yourself a universe-making machine, and then you set these dials to whatever you want, press the start button, and see what kind of universe comes out. After a few billion goes, you'd find this is a very boring experiment. It matters what you set these to. If you get the Big Bang force just a bit too high, the universe expands so rapidly that it can't form stars, galaxies, planets, human beings. There's no structure in the universe. If you get the gravitational force just a bit too high, the universe appears, but gravity is so strong that it collapses in on itself in the opposite of a Big Bang, a big crunch. In order to get a universe like ours, these have to be just right. They have to be balanced to one part in 10 to the power 60. If your mind switches off with the mathematics, that's rather like being blindfolded, given a bow and arrow, and then being asked to hit a target 1 centimetre squared on the other side of the universe. If you hit it, that's 1 in 10 to the power 60. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not going to say, therefore God. You know, God's the only explanation of this. In question time, someone inevitably will raise multiverses and all the rest of it. Because there are scientific explanations and metaphysical explanations about this. But for Paul Davis and others, these balances are so extraordinary that they find themselves saying, is there a deeper story to the universe than just the scientific explanation? Or what about intelligibility? Albert Einstein once said, the most incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it's comprehensible. I mean, why is it that we can sit here on a, is it a Tuesday night? Yeah, on a Tuesday night, and talk about the universe right back to 10 to the minus 43 of a second. And it's comprehensible. Well, I hope it's comprehensible a little bit too. I mean, why can we do that? What provides the common ground between the mathematics of our minds and the mathematics of our universe? John Polkinghorne, a former Cavendish particle physicist, talks about how, for him, God is the common ground of the rationality of our minds and the universe. And what about this sense of awe? I mean, I don't just mean the pretty pictures. The fact that underneath the complexity of the universe is simplicity and elegance. Now, for those of you who are scientists, you'll say, yeah, but most of the time science is boring and tedious and frustrating and is about writing research grants and experiments that don't work and all the rest of it. And absolutely. But there are moments for scientists, so-called wow moments, where in the tedium and frustration you just see the beauty and elegance and simplicity of the universe, sense of awe. Now, none of these things, I want to say, are proofs of the existence of God. For me as a Christian, they are wholly consistent with my belief that the universe is creation. And for some, they may point to a deeper story in the universe. Final point, you've been very patient, and then we'll have some question and answer. And that's the question of revelation. Or how can God be known? Because you might say, okay, you can't prove God through the Big Bang, you can't disprove God through the Big Bang. You've talked about maybe pointers for some. You've talked about the kiss and how you can hold the two together. But how do you get to the God part? After all, science has its facts and its theories. You've talked about that. Is the other bit, as Richard Dawkins with his sometimes characteristic humility says, faith is the great cop-out, the great excuse to evade the need to think and evaluate evidence. Is that what faith is about? Well, I don't think so. A number of years ago, John Taylor wrote a book about black holes. In it, he didn't talk a lot about black holes. He talked about why he didn't believe in God, and his argument went something like this. He said, the universe is very, very big. In fact, it must be infinite. Our minds are very, very small, finite. How can a finite mind ever understand an infinite God? He said, well, actually, we can't, and therefore there's no point talking about God, there's no point in believing in God. And he's got a point up to a point, if you see my point. And that is, how can the finite mind ever understand an infinite God? But, says the Christian, with respect, what if the infinite God decided to reveal himself to the finite mind in a way that the finite mind could understand? That seems to me to be a logical possibility. In fact, actually, for Christians, it's more than just a logical possibility. It's a central point of their faith, that God has decided to reveal himself in a way that we can understand. The writer of the letter to the Hebrews says that God has done this in many and various ways, but supremely in his Son, Jesus. So at the beginning of John's Gospel, John does a most remarkable thing. He takes two concepts in the ancient world, the Greek idea of logos, the word, the scientific rationality behind the universe, and he puts it together with the Hebrew idea of the word, which is God's personal creative activity. That's why it says in Genesis, God said, and it was so. And John puts the two together, and he writes, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And we are just bowled over by that. I can see it on your faces tonight, that John, what an amazing thing to do, to say that the scientific rationality behind the universe is God's creative personal activity. Just as we're getting over that, John writes, and the Word became flesh, a human being, and lived amongst us full of grace and truth. For we beheld his glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father. No one has ever seen God, the only Son he has made him known. You see, the Christian conviction is not that you can prove God through logic, or you can argue to belief in a creator God. It's to say that supremely, God has become a human being amongst us in Jesus. And we have encountered that in the space-time history of the universe. I became a Christian not by looking through a telescope and doing some science. I became a Christian because I read the stories of Jesus in the New Testament. And I came to a point where I asked Jesus to be real in my life. I mean, to be honest, I only know a little bit of science, and to be honest, I only know a little bit of theology. But the little that I do know, I find is held together by Jesus of Nazareth. That's why I believe in a creator God. And that's why I believe in a creator God who is love. I've talked far too long, and forgive me for that. Let me stop here, and then we can have some comments and questions and criticism and whatever you want to throw at me. Thank you very much indeed.